Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Hey Matt, back in the studio and looking forward to jumping into back into the Gospel of John.
I've been enjoying this, Stu.
Yeah, me too.
It's been great working through John.
And it's interesting because, for me anyway, because we've been going back through passages that are probably some of the most familiar to most Christians and even some that aren't Christians. And even the passages we're going to be looking at today, you know, some of the most well-known miracles of Jesus. Mm. And yet, I'm discovering something new every time I read them, and greater understanding, greater depth of understanding. So really looking forward to this one. We're picking up, folks, for those that are listening, from John chapter 4, and we're going to be working through as best we can. Anyway, we'll see how we go from John chapter 4 through to John chapter 7. And, of course, we start to see here John's accounts of some of Jesus's miracles. Mm. And particularly we kick off in John chapter 4 with the well-known story.
Jesus and the woman of Samaria.
Yeah.
It's the probably a little bit of background here is in order, Stu, because the obviously, and some of our listeners may be familiar with this, but there was this ongoing tension between Jews and Samaritans. Now, this begins, of course, Samaria, the word Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom. So remember going back after the time of Solomon, the 12 tribes, the kingdom of Israel, United Kingdom of Israel, was split in two.
Yeah.
You have the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom then. And the capital of the northern kingdom was Samaria. And, of course, the northern kingdom was destroyed by the Assyrians, 722 BC. The Assyrians took most of the people into exile, and they resettled Assyrians there, right? And so you get this kind of mix. There were some people that remained. You get this mix of sort of Assyrians, and so you get this hybrid people in Samaria that continue there. They do they observe a mix of religious practices
and festivals,
including a bit of traditional Yahwism. You know, the sort of mix in a little bit of the biblical faith. Mm. Now, after the southern kingdom went into Babylon, then they came back. This is to cut a long story short. You remember, you know, the story of Nehemiah and all the trouble that Nehemiah was having?
Yes.
With the people that were constantly opposing the rebuilding of Jerusalem.
Yep.
They were Samaritans. They were the guys, you know, up in the north who didn't want this this southern kingdom to become powerful and so forth. Mm. And so you know, at first that they are seen as this kind of hybrid idolatrous sort of people there in the north, and then they just become outright annoying, you know, like they become enemies essentially from the time of Nehemiah onwards. And then it just kind of gets worse and worse and worse from there. So there's all of this rivalry. In the early 300s BC, the Samaritans build a rival
temple
up on Mount Gerizim. Now, Mount Gerizim was the place, according to Deuteronomy, I think chapter 11, where Moses blessed Israel from Mount Gerizim. Mm. So they chose that spot. And, you know, for them, they were saying, this is the mountain of the Lord. Now, there's nothing in Deuteronomy that says that it had to be Jerusalem, that particular, you know, I mean, there are later scriptures that talk about Jerusalem as God, you know, Mount Zion as God's chosen mountain and all of this sort of stuff, but that's later. Mm. Certainly, there's nothing in the earlier scriptures that says it has to be, you know, that particular mount. So, you know, so they come up with this rival temple. Now, it was destroyed already, you know, by the first century.
Yeah.
It had been destroyed first, actually, Antiochus Epiphanes, who was, you know, famously tried to Hellenize the whole area of you know, the traditional land of Israel. Mm. He built a pagan shrine, you know, as they did on that mountain, and then later on, one of the Jewish kings during the Hasmonean dynasty, which is this 100 year after the famous Maccabean Wars when they won independence from the Greeks.
Yep.
And you had that 100 year kingdom, 100 year independent Jewish kingdom. They took control of that northern kingdom, and the king destroyed the temple. So which just then caused more hatred between Jews. It just gets worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
And so when Jesus is having this conversation with the Samaritan woman,
but
it's destroyed.
Yeah, totally. And the and important to say too that the Samaritans were very familiar. That they believed in the first five books of the Hebrew Bible in the Torah, but pretty much not much else. So they were, you know, they were very much in that. They had similar festivals, you know. So it wasn't like they were a completely separate pagan thing.
Yeah,
there was
right,
a
yeah.
mix of sort of Gentile and Jewish tradition. So this conversation then, as you say, the temple had been destroyed.
And they're probably in view of it, actually, which is interesting to where this – now they have – because he goes to this this location, Jacob's well. We don't actually have a story in the Old Testament of Jacob digging a well, but according to tradition, he didn't. There's no reason to doubt that he did.
And I think important to note too that geographically he didn't have to go via Samaria to where he was going. So there was clearly a purpose. Jesus was going to Samaria, and this is probably it. And in fact, he spent some time there, which we'll hear about shortly. But where he was heading, he didn't have to go through Samaria.
Yeah.
So even though it says he had to go, he had to go from a missional point of view.
Yeah,
not
that's
from
right.
a geographical point of view.
And this is an interesting theme throughout. Throughout the book of John is Jesus' focus on particular individuals.
Yes.
It's like he goes out of his way to connect with these particular individuals. It's just remarkable.
Yeah.
And here it's, you know, it's in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. He's been walking this journey. I mean, and evidently he's absolutely parched with thirst. Now he comes to this well. These wells didn't have like a bucket. We imagine a bucket. You bring your own vessel. You can't get water out of a well. And this was a really, really deep well too.
Yeah.
So there's no way of getting water out of this well. So he's there at the well. He's thirsty. You know, he's waiting. Now, of course, he knows he's set up this meeting beforehand. This is what's beautiful about this.
Yeah.
So this straggler comes out to the well. Now, normally, when women came to these wells, they would come in groups and they would come in the early morning. Generally, you wouldn't come in the middle of the day in the heat of the
day.
And you certainly wouldn't come alone. Mm. Now, this indicates that this woman is a complete outcast, that she comes on her own. She comes in the middle of the day. She's actually wanting to avoid other people,
which
maybe indicates something of the hostility of the community to her. And that may be because of these her situation, which comes up later. Mm-hmm. So there she is. Jesus speaks to her and asks her for a drink.
Yeah.
And, you know, she remarks, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?" Now, she's surprised because first of all, she is considered ceremonially unclean, traditionally, for the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Even her vessel, even to drink from her vessel, is to be defiled, right? Mm. So he's asking her, you know, he's asking her for a drink. So hence her surprise at that. And at that point, you know, he jumps into this. I don't know. Has he had a drink yet?
Exactly.
He jumps into this conversation, which he's always planned to have with her. This is, he's there for her, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, he says, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water."
Mm.
Now, this is, as we find out later on, this is one of the few occasions where Jesus actually outrightly says, "I am the Messiah," you know, like,
yes.
I am the Messiah. So here is, and this is to this outcast Samaritan woman.
Yes.
That receives this very direct revelation of who Jesus is. So he's jumping right into it. And, you know, she says, "You have nothing to draw water with."
Mm.
And, you know, this is where he goes into this beautiful, beautiful sort of metaphor that he uses about the water of life and about thirsting. And I will give you water that will become a spring of living water within you. It's beautiful because of the association between water and the Holy Spirit. And, you know, you got Ezekiel chapter 36, you know, that which talks about God sprinkling clean water and giving them a new heart. And
you'll never thirst again.
And you'll never thirst again. Mm. And Jesus says to her, "Go call your husband." She says, "I don't have a husband." It's interesting that he actually says, it's translated the word husband there, but the Greek word there is sort of it could be man or husband. So go call your man.
Right.
So it's kind of ambiguous because, of course, he knows that she doesn't have a husband.
Yeah.
He just shows that he knows. You've had five men. The one you're living with now is not your husband.
Yeah.
Look, this is probably why she's, you know, as I said, it's probably why she's an outcast. How's her diversionary tactics here? Isn't that great? When you're on the edge of sort of feeling that's that kind of, you know, you're on the edge. And look, he's not saying it to shame her. You know, he's not doing it for that reason. He wants her to know that he knows you are known. Yes. You know, he's gone out of his way to come and meet with her. Mm. It's about her being known, mm. not her being shamed. So she does this diversionary, you know, her father's worshipped on this mountain, but you say that, so she goes straight to the
dispute between the Samaritans dispute. And the Jews, yeah.
This is something in my conversations with people, Stu, you know, when you get to that point where that maybe they're feeling a bit challenged or a bit, like they'll jump to a controversial, oh, well, so what do you think about, they'll jump, you know, jump to a controversial, there's a bit of a diversionary tactic. Let's get this away from the heart and more about just abstract kind of controversy. So she brings this up. He makes a really important point. Listen,
yes.
I mean, and it's interesting. You know, thinking that you're probably, you know, Gerizim, even the ruins of Gerizim are in sight. There's been all of this controversy about which is the right mountain. And he uses this opportunity to say, listen, a time is coming and has now come when you'll no longer worship on either of the mountains, but you'll worship the Father in spirit and in truth. As we know, Jesus predicted the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. So that temple is going to be in ruins soon too. But it's also pointing to this new era that he is ushering in.
It's not about where you worship. It's about who you worship at the end of the day.
Exactly.
And it's interesting because he never answers directly any of her questions. He only speaks to her needs, you know. So she asks these questions and he just goes straight to her needs.
It's great.
You know,
It's great. Well, she says, I know that the Messiah is coming. Mm. You know, it's oh, I'm glad you brought that up. And this is where he says in verse 26, chapter 4, verse 26, Jesus said to you, I who speak to you am he. Mm-hmm. And the disciples come back. They're shocked, actually, that he's speaking to them at so many levels, actually.
But they don't actually ask him about that. You know,
they don't dare.
No, exactly.
Yeah, they're probably used to the fact that he does things a bit differently.
They almost suggest, mate, are you not well? Do you need to eat something? It's like, do you know what you're doing? It's almost like he must be delirious. He's speaking to the Samaritan woman. Let's make sure he gets some food.
Well, first of all, he's speaking to a woman. And actually, in that culture.
That's right.
It was even controversial, actually, to teach a woman, unfortunately, in that culture. That's the way it was. So that's the first thing that's surprising in this cultural context. The second is that it's a Samaritan woman. You know, I mean, it's so many levels. You know, this is why they're surprised. She goes into town. And the interesting thing here is one of the big themes in John's gospel is this the good news and believing in the good news and also projecting into the context in which John is writing, you know, later on in the first century, when the imperative is to be witnesses.
Yes.
Go out and be witnesses, you know, and to, you know, to great self-risk, really. The great thing about this here is that she goes immediately and she bears witness to Jesus. Yeah. You know, that's the first thing, you know, he reveals himself to her and she goes into her community and she gathers people and she brings all of these people to Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, this Samaritan woman. And all that's happened is that he's just told her a little bit about her life and she believes, right?
Yes.
Based on that, she believes. Just that's, you know, whereas he's done all of these other miracles elsewhere and it's just caused division and people are trying to find reasons to not believe and actually rouse crowds against him even. And yet here is this Samaritan woman. This is the kind of contrast that are being built here. Mm. Here is this Samaritan woman who goes and she brings all of these people. And so you get this movement. This sort of initial, if we can call it, Christian movement in Samaria.
Yeah,
you know,
it's amazing.
It's
interesting because that pattern, and you may have been going to allude to this later, but that pattern where the non-Jewish people tended to find the ability to believe without the miracles, you know, they just trusted, you know, the centurion, there's a number of stories, whereas the Jews were always looking for the signs and the wonders. And
that's right.
And here's this woman who just hearing what Jesus has to say, believes.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's right. And
so much so that he goes back and spends 2 days in the village.
Yeah, because they urge him to stay.
Yeah.
You know, whereas in other situations, there's clearly he's not really welcome. You know, like Nazareth the prophet is not welcome in his home, in his own town. And yet here in Samaria, they urge him to stay. You know, it's that, and again, there's that, remember the language of he tabernacled amongst us in John chapter 1. You know, he is the presence. You know, we have seen his glory. Well, who has seen his glory? The Samaritans. Mm. It's amongst them, the Samaritans. That, and when you think in the context of the controversy between temples, remember the temple was the symbol of God's presence among the people. So in the light of this controversy, which she's brought up, it is actually amongst them, the Samaritans, that he tabernacle stays. Yeah. You know, that, and that's the kind of word that's used there. So it's just beautiful. One of the themes actually through the Gospel of John, and he brings this up here, is this constant idea that Jesus is always doing the will of the Father, that he's only doing the things that he sees the Father, this constant responsiveness to God, right? Yeah. And even this sense that no one, and we'll see further on, you know, no one can come to me unless the Father draws them. There's this sort of particularity, and there's a theological theme through the Gospel of John about this particularity. God leads, you know, Jesus is doing the exact things that
the Father,
because it's not just anyone and everyone. It's actually particular people that see Jesus going out of his way. And there's a sense of the sovereignty of God, and that God is leading it. Now, of course, we know Jesus is the very incarnation of God, but he's modeling something. This is the point. He's also modeling something. He's modeling a life that is completely spirit led. And so, you know, he says down in verse 34, because they bring up the food thing because they think he's delirious.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I'm not. See, his answer to that is, no, I'm not delirious.
Yes, that's right.
It's not like I'm not talking to this woman just because I've had a lapse and I'm a bit lightheaded because I haven't eaten. He's, you know,
verse 30. I have food to eat that you don't even know about, he says in 32, and then goes on into verse 34.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. My food is to do the will of the one who sent me to accomplish his work. Mm. So he's saying, no, that actually is more important. That this is what I'm on about here. And so, speaking into the intentionality of this whole journey. This is why we went, because they're probably wondering, why are we going through Samaria?
Yes, exactly.
They're probably wondering, I mean, we don't
this get- This is the long way.
Yeah, we don't get that, but there's no doubt that they would have been wondering, why are we going through Samaria?
Yeah.
It's probably dangerous for a start, and it's an unclean place. So the next miracle is Jesus healing an official's son. This is where you go, you know, from someone at the very bottom of the pile to someone, you know, at the top. So this is obviously a fairly important.
So this is 2 days. He stays in Samaria for 2 days and then goes on to Galilee.
He goes to Cana in Galilee. So he's come back to where he was when he turned the water into wine.
Yes.
A man comes from Capernaum. Mm-hmm. So it's about a day's journey, you know, it's good day's walk.
Yeah.
So this guy's come a long way. The statement, because this is about his son who was ill. And Jesus said to him, verse 50, go, your son will live. That actually echoes with the widow of Zarephath, Elijah, and the widow of Zarephath. Similar statement is made. The difference here is that Jesus just says it, you know, and it happens. And so he doesn't actually go back to Capernaum.
Yeah,
he just says, go home, your son will live.
Yeah.
And so he's on his way home, and when he gets home, he finds out that at the very time when Jesus said that, his son was healed. Now, this is important for John, again, important for John's theme, because remember, in the beginning was the Word, right? So he gives the Word and it's done. And so that's an important sort of extension of that theme. These accounts move fairly quickly, Stu, as we go into chapter 5.
Yeah.
We have this story about Jesus going to the pool, the Bethesda, the pool of Bethesda. And there's a interesting sort of superstition around this pool. These things tend to build up in these, it was certainly not endorsed by the Jewish authorities. So in a sense, you get Jesus going into all these different situations where this mix of confused ideas is into Samaria, and he's, you know, he's dealing with Jewish legalism, but he's also dealing with superstition as well. And so there's this superstition around this pool that, you know, that the angels stir up the water. And if you're the first one in the pool when that happens, you know, you get healed. Now, we don't know how they came to that. But here's a guy that's been there for 38 years and he's never been able to get in there first. He's given it a red hot try.
But then Jesus asks this really interesting question. do you want to get well? You know, that's the first question he asks them. And I guess, you know, and I'm not sure about this, but I guess perhaps there were some people who made a lot of money out of being unwell.
Yeah.
You know, people were generous in so it's like, actually, do you want to get well?
Yeah, that's quite possible. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he'd been an invalid for 38. We don't know how long he'd been there beside the pool, but, you know, he says, you know, famously, get up, take up your bed and walk. Again, you know, it's just at his command, and this happens. Now, the problem here, of course, Stu, is that this happens
on the Sabbath.
On the Sabbath, and I know in our time, this doesn't seem like a big deal. Like, what's the big deal? But for Jewish people at that time, there were two incredibly important markers of your identity. One was that you kept the Sabbath. The other is that you were circumcised. Mm. Circumcision and keeping in the Sabbath were the two vital things that marked you out and made you distinctly Jewish. So this is a real identity thing. So they were very particular about things that what you could do on the Sabbath.
Yep.
Now, you couldn't pick up and carry your bed on the Sabbath. Interestingly, you could carry a sick person on a bed on the Sabbath, according to according to the rabbis.
Yep.
You know, they came up with all of these sort of casuistic ways, which is little rules for everything.
Yes.
You know.
Yep.
And so, yes, you could carry someone on a bed, but you couldn't pick up your bed and carry it. So as long as the sick person stayed sick,
it was fine.
That was fine.
So the issue wasn't that Jesus healed the man on the Sabbath. It was that the man picked up his bed
and
carried it.
And but remember, Jesus told him, pick up, go. You know, and so that becomes the controversy here. So,
at the time, of course, the man didn't know who he was because he didn't reveal himself.
Yeah, that's right.
So later, Jesus finds him.
That's right. Yep. So he finds him, and he, you know, I mean, he says, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." The idea here isn't that everything bad. You know, that everything bad. I mean, Jesus counters that idea elsewhere.
Mm.
The fact that something that you're a cripple or you're blind doesn't mean that something bad has happened to you. What Jesus is pointing to there is that there's actually something worse than being physically crippled. So just because you are healed from your state of being crippled, you know, don't just think, oh, everything's all right now. No, because you've still got a spiritual problem, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think you're spot on. I mean, it's not suggesting, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's not suggesting that he was a cripple because of sin.
No, that's right.
And, and what it's really saying is, as you've said many times, you know, the worst thing you could do is be happy without God.
Yeah.
So essentially he's saying, you might think being a cripple was bad, but actually what's worse is separation from God.
Yeah, that's right.
And don't continue living a life of sin because that's even worse.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting, Jesus' answer to the complaints of the Jews who complain, you know, come to Jesus and complain that he's given this, take up your mat and walk. Mm. He points at verse 17. He says, "My Father is working until now and I am working." Now, how you might wonder, how is that an answer? Well, he's actually talking about Genesis 2, verse 1 and 2, where it talks about God rested on the seventh day. It was understood, actually, the Jews understood that wasn't inactivity on God's part. That was actually a rest of ruling, but that there was a constant creating and sustaining activity. And so Jesus is sort of picking that kind of stream of thought, saying, I did this because God is still at work, right? On the Sabbath, God resting on the Sabbath does not mean that God doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
God is at work. And so therefore I am, and this comes back to this theme, I did this because it's what God is doing, right? So, you know, he's pointing, you know,
strong
it's a great
statement.
Answer to,
yeah,
and
yeah,
it's a strong statement. It's a great answer to these Jewish people that, you know, the Sabbath is about doing what God does. And, you know, God was at work here, and that's the main thing, guys. Like, it's not, you know, God is at work here. Can you not see that? That's basically what he's saying.
And then he goes on to kind of say the Son is not able to do anything on his own, but only what he sees the Father doing. So essentially he's saying straight away, God did this, and I'm doing it because essentially
I
am God.
That actually, as you say, Stu, this leads on to a bit of teaching that Jesus gives about his own authority, the authority of the Son. I mean, this is incredibly inflammatory. I mean, this really,
This is the beginning of the...
Yeah, Jesus is becoming increasingly polarized. Yeah. So what we're going to see from this time on is Jesus saying things that just seem... It's not like he's looking to smooth things over and draw a crowd and appeal. No. He's quite happy, actually, to polarize people.
He's just speaking the truth.
Yeah, there are people like the Samaritan woman and the cripple and those who actually follow him and they have these revelations of who he is. Mm. On the one hand, you see Jesus actually going and embracing these people, right? But on the other hand, you see him almost – it's like he's deliberately offending the sensibilities of people – to sort of, you know, put them offside almost deliberately. Yeah. But it's more like Jesus always has this polarizing effect that he, you know, if there's faith there, he'll draw it out. If there's hard-heartedness there, that will be drawn out as well. And that has a strong sort of, that's a strong theme throughout the Old Testament. You know, Pharaoh, God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that God caused Pharaoh's heart to be hardened. It's that his heart was hard, and in a sense, God compounds that, you know, to those who have, more will be given, you know, in terms of ability to see and respond, Jesus said, and those who do not have, even what they have will be taken away from him. Jesus says that in the context of a willingness of heart, right? So we'll move forward, Stu, to the end of chapter 5. You've got this, the question about witnesses. This is important. You know, who is bearing witness to this? Because he's saying these controversial things. So he points out a number of different witnesses. There's John, who's been borne witness to him. His works, he appeals to his works. My works bear witness to me. So in a sense...
And remembering that witness was a very important sort of principle in Jewish culture
that's right.
at that time. Yep. So this is speaking very much to what was considered to be an important aspect.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, truth finding, I guess, by the Jews.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. He talks about, like, first there's John, then his own works. The Father bears witness to him. Mm. That may be referring to that when God spoke, this is my Son whom I love, as well as the works of God, you know, through him. The scriptures, he talks about the scriptures bear witness to him. And then he goes on and he says, the reason that you don't believe is because in verse 44 of chapter 5, how can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from... This is the thing. You're defending your turf here. You're defending your authority and you're not... This is why you're not... So he really calls it, you know, and that bridges right. So you've got this polarizing situation happening. The sequence here is important, Stu, because you've got this increasingly polarizing situation. And then you've got this miracle in chapter 6 of the feeding of the 5,000, which actually is because it's 5,000 men.
Yes.
You're probably talking about could be up to 20,000 people.
Because you've got women and children.
That is an enormous amount. Think of a stadium, you know, like Amy Stadium or something in Melbourne. I think that's like about 20,000. 20,000 people is a big day but that could be because it's the soccer.
Yeah.
Anyway. so just a lot of people here.
Yeah, that's right. And interesting about this miracle, this is the only miracle, perhaps apart from the resurrection, this is the only miracle that's actually in all four Gospels, that's recounted in all four Gospels.
Yeah, right.
Just this one.
And part of the importance of that too is that this is Jesus being the greater Moses.
Yes.
Because the significance of this, of course, is the manna, the manna from heaven. Yep. In fact, he goes on to talk about him being the bread of life, that he actually is the manna that comes from heaven.
Yeah.
And he gets his disciples in on this. I mean, we see this in all four Gospels. The disciples are part of this. So he says to Philip, you know, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? Philip lives just nearby. So that's why he asks Philip.
Yeah.
But he says this to test him. You know, Philip says this is completely impossible. And so Jesus does this amazing miracle where he multiplies the bread and the fish that are brought. And you've got 12 basketfuls left over.
Yeah.
You know, and this is God's provision for his people. You know, he's got 12 disciples, the 12 tribes of Israel. It's full of significance. This miracle, because this is, this is kind of a new exodus that's happening here.
And I think that flows into the next miracle, which we'll get to in a moment too.
Yeah.
You know, a similar thing, you know, in terms of walking on the water as opposed to the parting of the waters.
Yeah, that's right.
You know.
Yeah. And so you move from the feeding of the 5,000 or, you know, as many 20,000 people. The symbolism of the water too is just so, because again, the association of water and the forces of chaos and,
yes,
and bodies of water of being almost like the gates of death, you know, the gates of Sheol or Hades in Greek. And so, you know, Jesus walking on the water has this extra significance of, you know, he's walking on top of the chaos and death, and he's not being drawn down.
Yeah.
And so he is the Lord over chaos and death. It's so heavily symbolic, this miracle, which is also, it's the same thing at work when the sea parts during the time of Moses.
Yes.
Because, and it talks about walls of water standing up to the right and left. So that's the forces of death and chaos are held back to allow the people to pass through.
Yeah.
And so this is that, but with extra significance, because it's not just parting the water so Jesus can, he's actually walking on top of the water. So that's, you know, extra significance there. And then he talks about himself in the light of these miracles, particularly with the association with the manna that came down from heaven. He basically points out to them that he is the manna, he is the bread of life that comes down from heaven. He has come down from heaven, and those who, as it were, feed on him will have eternal life and shall never hunger or thirst, you know. And so you've got these themes, that the thirsting theme from the well in Samaria.
Yes.
You've got the bread of, you know, the hungering theme.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's all tied together here, and quite a long, this actually is quite a long bit of teaching that we have in John chapter 6.
And it ended up being quite confusing for many of the disciples at the time. In fact, some chose, as a result of him, you know, talking about eating his body and drinking his blood, that, you know, they were thinking physically, we need to, how are we going to eat his body and drink his blood? And that actually saw a lot of people actually leave.
Well,
and it's easy for us to look back now. I was thinking to myself, it's easy for me to look back now and go, oh, what fools, you know. But, you know, imagine if that was us and someone was saying that and we didn't fully understand what was being said here.
Oh.
We'd probably be thinking, this guy's, what's this guy on about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, particularly with the sort of sensibility of Jewish sensibility. I mean, you never drink blood. Like, that was just an absolute no-no in those days.
Mm.
And, you know, the idea of, you know, unclean flesh and, I mean, goodness me. The sermon's going well, Stu, but gradually gets more and more, the claims get bigger.
Yeah.
And then right at the end there, again, this is this polarizing effect because he's probably got quite a following in this area. Yeah. There's a lot of people that are, you know, a lot of crowds.
Mm.
And remember, we've already heard him said that he entrusts himself to know, because he knows, you know, what's in the heart of person. Yeah. And so he's very wary of these crowds. Mm. And so
who were really probably just looking for another miracle or sign. It was more like, we want you to do another magic trick kind of thing, as opposed to thinking about the spiritual context.
Yeah, that's right.
Context of what he was doing.
His teaching on the whole bread of life theme begins with him saying to these people that come looking for him, listen, you're looking for me because I fed you bread.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. But actually, what you really need is the true bread of life, you know, and this is where he talks about, I am the bread of life. So in a sense, he goes from, they come to him for another feeding, miraculous feeding miracle.
Mm.
But he says, no, that's actually not what you need. Mm. That's just a sign to point to something bigger.
Mm.
And the sign actually is that I am the bread of life. And then that's when he goes on to, and if you eat my flesh and drink my blood, and they're like, no, thanks.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, he loses this, and it's very, it actually, it's hard. You know, this is, it gets to a sad point, doesn't it, Stu? Because the disciples, many of his disciples, this is a hard saying. And the word there is actually, it's quite a strong word. This is an offense. That's just an offensive. And, you know, Jesus says in verse 61, do you take offense of this?
Yeah.
You know, and it says in verse 66, after this, many of his disciples turn back and no longer walk with him. So you get this falling away, and actually between chapter 6 and chapter 7, there's a bit of a silent period here, because you get a bit of a gap, and you sense, wow, things are, they're certainly not going the way maybe his disciples had hoped.
Yes.
You know, because now he's quite, even though he's done these miracles, a lot of people have turned away from him. They're quite offended at him. The Jewish leaders want to kill him.
Mm.
And so then he comes to Jerusalem to the Feast of Booths, which is, you know, associated where they would build these temporary booths to commemorate their dwelling in the wilderness. Now, a big part of the Feast of Booths, because remember also there was the water from the rock, which was the bringing of the water from the rock, a miracle that God performed through Moses. This actually has a key place in this festival. So over 7 days, they would take water from the pool of Siloam and they would take it up and pour it out, you know, in the temple. There was this festival each day. So it's in this context that, you know, that Jesus is going to talk about the water of life. He's going to come back to this theme of the water of life.
Just probably important to mention too, his brothers wanted them to go on and do more signs and miracles to kind of convince everything by, again, the signs and wonders thing.
That's an interesting thing, isn't it, at the beginning of
this? Whereas Jesus is going, no, I'm actually going to not do that. I'm going to go in quietly and secretly because I don't want to speak to that. I actually want to speak to the heart. I don't want to speak to the signs and wonders that people go, wow, that's amazing. I want to actually speak to the real issue, which is the heart.
Well, that's an interesting point, Stu, actually, because you know, by the end of chapter 6, lots of people are turned away from him.
Yeah, that's right.
You get this time, a bit of time goes by. But you actually sense here that his brothers are getting a bit frustrated. Mm. Come on, like, are you, is it?
Yeah, just do some of that magic stuff again. That'll convince everyone.
What are you, doing, mate? Like, and in fact, the way that they speak to him in verse 4 of chapter 7, you know, for no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to, you know, this is actually sounds very much like the temptations of Satan.
In the
desert, if you're the son of God, show yourself, everyone will know and you'll be able to. Mm. And this is why it says in verse 5, for not even his brothers believed in him. Mm. You know, if you are the son of God, then do this, you know. So I know that sounds like his brothers are trying to encourage him and maybe, you know, people might think that it sounds like they actually explicitly says they said this because they didn't believe. And they're really, you know, so you really get his own brothers, his own family really essentially are turning away, turning against him.
And you can kind of understand that. I mean, again, I try to put myself in their context and go, this is my brother. And he's been doing these, that was cool, what he did there. But now he's talking about eating flesh and drinking blood. And it's like, hang on.
Yeah.
You know, you're just my brother.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
you need a bit of PR help.
Yeah. It's easy for us to look back and kind of be, oh, what's wrong with those guys? But I think we've got to remember in this moment, this was pretty challenging stuff for everyone, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting because they tell him, go up to the feast, you know, and reveal, this is a great time for you to reveal yourself, which actually he does, but he says to them that he won't. Did you notice that? He says, no, I'm not going to go up.
Yes.
And then he goes up.
He does, like, in secret, and then later he appears in the temple.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, he's saying, I'm not going to go up in that, in that way. So anyway, but he goes up secretly. Mm. And then at one point, so no one, this is interesting because he goes up secretly. Maybe some of his disciples, you probably sense that his inner circle is still, but he's not going with crowds or.
No, that's right.
You know, and so at one point though, he starts teaching in the temple courts. And this is when straight away, what he's here. And he says something really interesting in verse 17, Stu. And this gets to this strong theme about, those who come to me will come because the Father draws them.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really interesting theme. And we already saw this in the last episode, Stu, when we talked about John chapter 3, that the wind blows where it will, you know, and you cannot see the kingdom of God unless you are born again.
Yes.
There's this strong, this strong theological theme in John is that those who come to Jesus actually come because the Father draws them. There's this sort of sovereignty theme in John.
And I think it's revealed by the Spirit. I mean, we sort of jumped over this, but at the very end of chapter 6, kind of alluding to the fact that you're trying to think in a human way.
Yeah, that's right.
This is a spiritual concept that you're completely missing. And the same thing here. It's kind of like God's going to reveal through his Spirit to those people who know this is the truth.
Yeah, that's right. In response to his teaching, a lot of people remark, you know, how is it that this man has such great learning? And he points out, well, you know, this is from God. And he says a very interesting thing in chapter 17, is from the ESV translation, a slightly more literal translation. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority. So again, this is this sense that there are some people that will have this insight, like from the outside, it's impossible to see that this is true.
Yeah, right.
But those who actually do this, who step into the inside, they will see from the inside that it's true.
That it is. Yeah.
It's like you cannot see the truth of it from the outside. It only can be seen from this position of faith on the inside. Again, it's consistent with this idea that you need to be born again to see the kingdom of God, which is it's just, that theme just runs. So it's because, you know, on the one hand, Stu, there's this strong theme of our responsibility to believe. It's John's constantly saying, you know, this is so that so that you might believe, you know, that whoever believes will, you know, and yet at the same time, you've got this theme of those who believe, you know, believe
because.
Yeah, because yeah. In a sense, it's always putting God prior. And it's not like we've got to be careful not to try and logically fit those together with too strict a sense of logic. Like, oh, well, it's this rather than that.
Yeah.
No, there's a strong emphasis on our responsibility to choose. And yet, but there's also a strong emphasis on our inability to see and without the Spirit of God. So somehow those two things fit together. And John just is happy to hold those things in tension. Classic sort of Jewish thinker.
Yeah.
You know, I think that later, later more sort of Greek mode of thinking is going to try and grapple with those and fit them together logically. But John's happy to hold those things in tension.
Yeah, it's good.
So he has these, you know, this leads to a sequence of teaching there in the temple, and it culminates
in more polarization.
Absolutely. There's more polarization here. In the second half, this is where he picks up this theme of the rivers of living water to come back to where we started in this episode, Stu, with the Samaritan woman. On the last day of the feast, throughout the feast, he's been doing this teaching, he's been having this polarizing effect, but he says, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me, come and drink. You know, Isaiah chapter 55, is echoed there, come to the waters and drink. He says, whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. So he says this, and then right at the end of the chapter, what do you get? Verse 43. So there was division among the people over him.
Yeah.
You know, he just has this, again, polarizing effect because he's bringing out the best in some and the worst in others and not much in between, actually. This is not just what God did in Jesus. This is what God does. We need to see the worst in ourselves and we need to see the best. So God stirs up the worst, brings out the best, and you see Jesus doing that in this. We get, did you notice there, Stuart, right at the end of the chapter, Nicodemus pops up again?
Yeah, yeah. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And interesting even too that, you know, these so-called, and I shouldn't be disrespectful, Pharisees, you know, making the comment, you aren't from Galilee too, are you? They replied, you know, suggesting he was kind of somewhat biased.
Yeah.
Investigate and you'll see that no prophet arises from Galilee, and yet Jonah was from Galilee. So they're actually factually incorrect themselves, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, they were expecting the Messiah to come out of Bethlehem.
Yes.
Which is what the prophecies point to, which actually we know that he did, but they didn't know that.
No,
so
that's right.
It's great stuff, Stu. And I think you get this picture. As you follow these stories, one of the things that strikes me is that this is not only what God did, this is what God does. And there's this increasing call here for this radical obedience. Are you really willing to follow? Are you really willing to trust, whatever the cost?
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.